Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it. Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, interviewing the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. And always with me by my side, Elizabeth Leiba. This is Dr. Joe Salustio. Elizabeth, how are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you for asking. How are you, Joe?
I'm doing very well. And, you know, I care so much about you. I'm just wondering if you've been able to get outside and get on those walks you've been talking about.
Next week. That's my goal. I'm shooting for next week.
It's 105 degrees here in Chino Hills, California, where I'm recording from today, so I won't be doing much outside. So it's good that we're on a podcast, because today we have a very special guest on the line, Andrew Coe, founder of Covexa. Andrew, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you, Joe.
Well, you know, we have got a lot to talk to you about. You have a very interesting background, and we're going to get into it in a minute. But how's your health? How's your family doing these very challenging times we live in today?
Well, thank you very much for Joe asking. They're doing great. Like everybody else, my children had a little bit of hiccup of the distance learning, but we're all rocking and rolling and working all together with all the teachers. So can't complain. Everyone is healthy, knock on wood, and we're in good mental and physical shape, and thank you for asking.
Well, that's great, and I always say that if people thought they were patient people before, once you have kids that are online and K-12 learning online, it tests every limit of patience that could be tested. So you really find out a few things about yourself that you didn't know before going through that process, I'll tell you what. So, you know, Liz and I are really curious, and I know our listeners are going to be really curious about Covexa, the founding of the company, you know, why you did it, where did you come from, which is a really critical piece of this story. So give us your background and then talk about Covexa.
Sure. Thank you very much. And it's always appreciated to have the opportunity to speak to folks like yourself. I'm excited to be on here. In a nutshell, I've had the real fortune and blessed career of spending 25 years, everything from management consulting to working for, you know, major high-tech companies around the world, trillion-dollar valuation company now. And as such, these companies include Deloitte, where I did a lot of reorganization and even restructuring of companies. And that led me on to really getting into technology. And that's where I had my benefit of working for companies like Microsoft for 12 years, helping a lot of teacher education, professional development, as working with policy in the White House's Connect Ed initiative during the Obama administration. And I went to Samsung, where I wanted to go look at the global world of education when it came to even devices and how mobile learning really affects education in all the parts of the world. And most recently, right before Covexa, I had the pleasure of working for an incredible company called Amazon Web Services. You've probably heard of it. Managing their, being their global managing director for education and workforce, of which I had the incredible purview of looking at thousands of ed techs and really pushing and evangelizing the real proper need for cloud technologies across higher ed, K-12, and even other type of secondary, post-secondary type of education, we'll call it organizations. For me, Covexa was a Jerry Maguire moment, I guess, is probably the easiest way I explain it to people. Half of it was a little crazy. No, I didn't get fired or I didn't steal the goldfish. But it was a moment in my career where I felt that I've always really wanted to improve education, post-secondary, as well as primary and secondary as well. And in this very seat that I'm sitting when COVID originally hit, not originally, but really got, I guess, really exploded, if you will, in that March timeframe, I had pulled into many university conversations with presidents, CIOs, as well as even K-12 locally here to where I reside in Ashburn, Virginia, Fairfax County, Los Angeles School District. And I just saw so much changes happening in such a short period of time. And what I realized is I felt like going out on my own. And I really enjoyed and leveraged the knowledge and the information and the partnerships and the good customers that I really had, really developed and cultivated as my customers, my partners, my lifelong friends, if you will. And they helped the band together to help me help other education institutions and ed techs really grow, but also hopefully knock on wood, transform and improve a little bit and really accentuate some of the silver lining that could really benefit from this terrible pandemic that we are facing right now.
Yeah, I mean, starting a business, coming from a role like yours, just such a role where you get to really see education from a number of perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. And starting a company during COVID, it takes guts. It takes
a little crazy.
Intention. Yeah, a little crazy.
Yeah.
Now you're in the help me help you kind of phase, and that's what we're going to hopefully do. The EdUp experience here is help me help you. Get the word out about your organization. Where's the focus? Talk to me about what the focus of Covexa is. Where's the impact and what's the plan, the vision?
Great. Thank you. And that's a great question because people like to see Covexa, but then understand like, okay, I know Andrew Coe, but boy, what is this thing? And I'm sure there's three things that I'm really conducting as a new business, but it's all threaded on two, we'll call it one key thesis, and that is improving education through the real true use of information. I always felt that education had a wealth of data, but not really actionable information that was used to the benefit of the learners or the faculty or even the administration and a variety of other, we'll call it individuals that could really benefit from that information. Secondly, I have always been a proponent of really driving, and you're gonna hear all these buzzwords, so I apologize, but like STEM or technology. We are woefully preparing our youth to really drive for a lot of the jobs in the future. And that is not just coming from any research, but myself as a hiring manager and all these companies, we always had a difficult time finding the right talent. And when we did, we had an incredible, tough, long cycle to ramp them up. So were they really career ready? I'm not sure. The skills there needed, in my opinion, to be introduced at a much earlier stage. And so I'd say the three things tying around those two premises of data and upskilling, I'm right now just advising several education technology companies that actually have some of the things I really like seeing, and I want to help them grow and get them into some really good visible areas so that they can continue to make change. Number two, I'm also going to start building some gaps or solutions in the gaps where I find where distance learning is falling short. Even myself, being in this space, the real one important fact that I probably missed in my introduction, I didn't get into education. Education kind of dragged me in because of my own children. They also have special learning needs, and this distance learning has been not just an eye-opener for me, but across the world where there's so much challenges of really optimizing distance learning for our most vulnerable individuals, including my kids. And so I want to now focus and emphasize a strategy, or you have some high-level idea of a wireframe of really affecting that particular world of special needs. And thirdly, I've been approached by many investors, potential investments, but also even flirting with the idea of even growing my own venture capital fund around this thesis. So those last two are a little bit on its way. It's developing, but I'm in startup mode. So I get to now talk freely. I get to talk to politicians, which is another area I would say that I did not realize when I first got into education that it was so political. And that's not even just in the U.S. I'm talking worldwide. I'm seeing very similar attributes of, I'll call it, challenges that can be opportunities to improve change. And again, going back where COVID is such a pervasive and profound impact that occurred around the world, where we literally had 1.9 billion students stop learning at the same time. And just think about that. Over 190 countries, 1.9 billion schools, I mean, learners, and the schools with them pretty much shut down for a while. And now it's like a race to see who are who are fixing things, and see who are really the innovators are now going to use this as an opportunity to transform. And that's kind of exciting to see. But I also want to be a part of that. I hope that answers your question there.
Yeah, it does. And you know, you bring up more questions, which is, I think, the point of the podcast. So we get to do what we do. Elizabeth, my co-host, is going to have a host of questions. I want to just ask one more to you. And you know, hits really central. Let me do a little bit of a build up here and then get your take. You know, higher education specifically has had its share of disruption. And I'm talking technology disruption. I'm talking about public trust disruption, mounting debt disruption, you know, value of a degree being questioned. Large, very, very wealthy organizations like Amazon, where you came from, Google, investing millions of dollars, Amazon specifically investing $700 million on training for their employees over the next 6 years to, you know, get them skilled up. That's outside of higher education. And so there's been this, I don't know, mounting question on, you know, does higher education have a monopoly on skills, and how do we open those up? How does higher education move more quickly? What needs to happen at a K through 12 level to get people more prepared and understanding about education and how, and there's just lots of questions. You were really in such a high level position looking at education at such a high level. What's your take? And this is a broad question, so take in whatever direction you want. What's your take on post-secondary ed, higher education, its value, what needs to happen to make it more valuable, and so on?
Yeah, it is a huge question, and this is the multi-billion dollar question, because right now, I would summarize it by, there is a tectonic push that's happening between time-based learning, what we're accustomed to in K through 12, the way our funding model works. At the end of the day, it is, you know, your learners' butts in seats and attendance that funds it. And there's other supplemental funding, but that's sort of primary driver. Degree-based and enrollment and post-secondary today, you know, writ large, I'm being general. And then skills, where companies are demanding not just any one of those two, but saying, hey, I need a very explicit type of skill that I need to nurture, create, and to have fully employed. Those three things, from a primary, secondary, post-secondary, and the corporate world, are all in sort of its battle, if you will, invisibly, but that's what's happening, because what's interesting about that overall is that students, parents are judging with their pocketbooks. And you're seeing a lot of individuals not go back to school to say, A, it's not worth it, right? So it debates the value and the cost of the degree. B, I'm just going to wait out and go online and get what I need in order to get a job. So some of them are, quite frankly, circumventing that whole degree process. Now, I'm not saying education and higher education will go away, but right now it is an incredible inflection point that definitely is occurring. And there will be winners and losers, unfortunately, especially in a market-driven, financially-driven, we'll call it environment, we are unfortunately going to see some universities close down that they already haven't been already. People don't always realize that many of these education systems, here's a couple facts, are already financially in challenging state even prior to COVID, right? Just look at the budget numbers. It's always been challenged. Number two, it's going to get worse next year. Why? Because of the budget, taxable in arrears. And I think the last time I checked NCES, for public institutions or post-secondary education, about 40% of them rely on state funding. Those fundings are in jeopardy, because right now no one's paying taxes, but the economy, the absolute connected tie between economics or the economy and education and K through 12. And so I don't mean to spew on all the challenges, but I think these are important people to realize that they're all interrelated. And I'll try to get to some quick, we'll call it high-level answers, and then maybe some tactical things that people can do. But let's talk about even K-12. In the U.S., a lot of Western economies, the U.K., Spain, there is a survey, I think UN did, that 60% of families can't get babysitters or people to take care of daycare of their kids while they have to go to work. And so this learning at home becomes now an additional burden to the economy, where they're seeing a lot of impacted jobs. I think at one point they calculated 400 million worth of jobs are in jeopardy globally because of just not having enough adequate babysitters or daycare so that learning can occur and both parents can go to work. And we're going to expect to see additional dropouts as a result. So it's this very much intricate vortex that we are in right now. Now, there's no perfect answer, I would say, unfortunately, but this is the area in time where I believe people have to be much more innovative, the way they offer curriculum, the way they provide curriculum. And I myself, a little biased, I'm always a proponent of introducing more compulsory or more, call it high-tech technology type of introductory courses at much earlier ages, earlier in our secondary, middle school, junior high school. That's where we lose young girls to STEM. And right now, when everything's online, you know, you should question, why do I need to always go to that physical school to go, you know, learn something that might not be, that I can get online now in another district? We need to think more risk, much more clustered around the areas here, work together, get rid of inefficiencies, and start to become much more adaptive to the curriculum as well as all those. And that should start to hopefully align up all those time-based versus degree-based versus skill and become much more of a clear pathway across the board.
Well, and you know, and Liz, you know this probably better than most. I mean, you know, Andrew, it's funny that you bring this up, and this is such an important perspective because higher education in general, when you talk about technology, there's two areas that I see where this happens. There's others, but technology and marketing. Marketing is part of tech. They move so fast that when you create curriculum, that curriculum has to change as fast as the technology changes, and that's very hard to do. Now, you're a big university. You have to make investments in changing curriculum. It has to go through like 87 committees and your predator in some kind. 88 committees. I was trying to get it on the low end to get something changed. And so there's a bureaucratic engine that works in higher education. It's called the committees. Someone, I don't remember who it was, said that the best committee is a committee of two when somebody one person shows up sick. So that's really challenging to keep up with. And now you're spitting out graduates who don't have the skills to perform in the job. So it causes business and industry to say, okay, wait a second. We need something more. We need these people to be work ready because now I've got to invest my money into getting them ready. And I was hoping they would be ready. That's a real big challenge for us in higher ed, which is why, you know, there's a movement to really partner with organizations to say, let's customize curriculum. I think that's a big movement. And Liz, you probably see this, Liz. I mean, curriculum updates are hard. You know, it's hard to keep up with certain technologies. Mm-hmm.
Hey everyone, this is Joe just reminding you to check out our website at www.edupexperience.com where you can find and explore all of the content that we've released under the EdUp Experience brand, including multiple podcast series, EdUp Elites, EdUp Embedded, and EdUp Experts. You can also suggest topics or guests for our podcast. Then head over to YouTube, check out our channel, The EdUp Experience, and you're going to find that my amazing co-host, Elizabeth Leiba, has started a new web series called EdUp Unplugged, where she talks about racism in America with special guests coming on that web series. We've got a lot going on at The EdUp Experience. Again, check out our website at www.edupexperience.com. Now let's get back to our guest.
It is hard because there's a whole process, and a lot of it, when we think about how higher education functions, Andrew alluded to it in the idea that it is, there's a political aspect in that it's not just the school that's operating as an independent entity. They have to answer to accreditation, and you know the accrediting, and you know this, Joe, from working at that level. I'm just a lowly faculty member, so I just see the effects of it, or an instructional design. I see when we have to roll out new curriculum, but the accreditor is coming in, and the accreditor is looking at your curriculum, and then there's syllabi to be updated, and there's books that need to be accompanying this additional or changed curriculum, revised curriculum that you decide to roll out. And then, like you said, everybody has to kind of weigh in and see if it's something that makes sense. So I'm just so fascinated by the idea of education being disrupted, because I think that we're probably the only one of the only sectors that hasn't seen major disruption, where a lot of it is built on tradition and us kind of maintaining certain level of just being very, I almost want to say complacent. We don't want to change. We don't want to pivot quickly. I don't want to disregard what happened in the wake of COVID, because in the wake of COVID, a lot of institutions did pivot very quickly to the online or to the remote or whatever they were doing. But how do you, Andrew, how do we get schools to reimagine how they think in terms of being more innovative, in terms of incorporating technology, in terms of being able to kind of forego some of these traditional methods of changing how they deliver and being a little bit more agile? Are there, do you have any tips or strategies for that? Or what do you think is the...
I would say I look at what's working. In addition to let me even take a step back, because there's so much there and there's really chock full of good things that I think are kind of important, at least in my opinion. Number one, going back to the curriculum, Joe and Elizabeth, you hit it right on the head. I literally tried to introduce an organization that offers a tremendous amount of curriculum, the ones that are certification driven, that employers like on Amazon want. I kid you not, one of the institutes, it takes 2 years to change that. And my jaw dropped, across the Zoom, 2 years, literally they said 2 years. And I said, well, I just want to be very, very clear. Couple things. Number one, learning is no longer just post-secondary. Learning is now this K to gray is like, I guess, the new term. I'm learning all these new lingos as well. I myself had to learn about robotics. And my degree, which was a long time ago, was in accounting. So I had to learn about robotics. Why? Because at that time, now it's public, but Amazon was releasing something called robotics as a service. Think about that. So that's the kind of stuff I'm being asked to learn. And I go look around, there's no community colleges, not just a vocational tech has it. And when it takes 2 years, my comment to them was, you've got to also realize technology, to Joe's point, changes in months now. There are no more annual big releases of products like the whole Windows era. Remember, there's a new Windows or a new iPhone, hardware maybe, but technology, because of cloud, it is happening in months, time frame, months. And so how does curriculum, if it takes 2 years, keep up with something that is so ever-changing within months? And I would say, the biggest challenge, even now, say, and I, by the way, the one other, I used to be on the State Board of Education. I was an appointee. Know some of the policy, not all in higher ed, but the comment I got back from this individual was, well, we don't have the faculty to go do that. And my retort to that was, actually, why do you need a faculty on your staff? There are plenty of people who can teach it online. Can you not just coordinate and either outsource it or work around the curriculum you have to embrace it and almost make a hybrid between your faculty and that? Because if everyone is trying to, the vicious cycle begins, if I'm trying to find a faculty member to learn all these things, do they want to stay there? They actually get recruited by one of these companies and hired away. So
you probably broke that person's brain. Andrew, you probably broke your brain talking like that. So they start sweating on their brow and go,
Well, and I'm not trying to break and debate faculty and all that, not at all. But right now, that is the demand. The demand is there. There is actually a shortage of certain type of skills out there around the world. Almost, I think, 18 million cloud jobs that were available a couple of years ago. That's before COVID. And now cloud just going to only increase. It's not going to decrease. And so why are we not preparing for what the demands are going to be right now and in the future? We're focusing on a lot of the things that may or may not be as important. I'll kind of leave it there. To answer your question about technology, Elizabeth, data, information. We are right now all struggling. Workforce, speaking to one of the governor's workforce advisors, 40% of unemployed were individuals that worked in hospitality or restaurants and food service industry. Now, I'm not going to say that every single one of them are going to be a developer or architect, but there are a whole tectonic shift of even jobs like marketing. even marketing. There's no more trade shows anymore, but now everyone's now learning how to do digital marketing. So the technology doesn't always have to be about coding. So I want to demystify that. But business now is going to drive around even the digital world. And that, you know, again, I'm going to throw another big word out, the fourth industrial revolution. We're in the middle of it. And sometimes I cringe when people go, yeah, 21st century learning. I'm like, let me just tell you all, we're in the third decade of that century we keep on talking about. So let's actually act like we're going to really understand the world that we're going to live in. And data is the new currency. And we need to appreciate it. We need not to fear it, of privacy and security. We need to have it secure and private. But some people fear it so much, the use of it, that it's going to be to our disadvantage.
Data is the new currency. I like that. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I give you the fact when I kind of hit it, when people don't understand what that means, Airbnb, and I haven't checked in a while, so you can fact check me here, but Airbnb's valuation was more than Hilton Worldwide Properties. Think about that. You know, the actual buildings and physical infrastructure of Hilton Worldwide Properties is worth less, according to the market, than Airbnb, who had probably have maybe an office building or two. I mean, so when you look at that just perspective, people are betting on future because they know that is the future. And I'm not saying they're not going to need hotel buildings, nothing like that. But people in the data and the information world of convenience and immediacy are extremely, and they're personalized and individualized. So why should our education not go down that same path?
What can schools do, though, if they want to make those practical connections and develop those partnerships? Like, what would you say in terms of advice that you would give to institutions that want to do that?
Yeah, I say there's really five things, and I'm going to try to make it as simple as possible. People, process, pedagogies, and products. And there's actually even, I'll call it legislation, but I haven't found the fancy P word to title around the legislation work there. The people. In education, we need to embrace sometimes the ability to experiment. I always say this, and again, I say it with a chagrin. It's like we always tell our students or learners, hey, it's okay, try. Failing is okay, try. We don't take that same behavior as adults in the education world. And that's just a general statement, I know. But we do need to now try and test new things out and embrace it and reward it. There is a very much, we've done this the way it is. And that was one of the questions I got when I was on the dais. And I retorted back to the individual, okay, it hasn't worked for 20 years. You think you want to try something new? It was my comment back, which I don't know if that threw me off the board later on, but that was one of those things is we got to change the mentality that it's okay to try and try new things all the time. We got to get into that. I've had many, many CIOs and presidents, well, I just don't want to be the first to do it. And I don't know, you spend a lot of time in education. That is a damning comment. We would never say that in the private sector world. Like that, I don't want to be the first to do it and try. Wow. So that culture, that people is probably the number one barrier, more than money and anything else. That's that. The processes. I know in education, we'd like to make judgments and decisions in a collective consensus. And that's important because you always want to make sure that there's equal access as well as conversations and whatnot. Sometimes you got to move forward and you got to like redesign even your internal processes, the procurements and the way you go make decisions on things. And not every institution, and I'm speaking a little bit more on the K-12 side, have to figure out themselves. We are very decentralized in our education and in our primary and secondary. And in Virginia myself, where I reside, we have 133 different districts that are fending for themselves every single individual thing. Everything from the type of device, the LMS. I mean, that is just efficiency and probably money could be spent a lot more in some consortia we're buying. Number three, pedagogies, we have to teach and learn that education is no longer just going to be in that physical classroom. Distance learning, even in post-secondary, where I saw the struggle was not necessarily always the technology in higher ed, even though it wasn't perfected, but it was a lot of the faculty also needed to learn that, wow, this online is just not a one-time thing. You might have to do it all the time. And how do I make assessments authentic? Like, how do I know mom and dad is not under the table? And there are technologies out there. but we haven't really even yet figured out all the intricacies of making learning full-time online all the time. And there's some gaps of technology that have to be there. And the products, I would say, so pedagogies, we got to train our faculty and educators. Like, we have to invest in it. Those are always the first things that they cut, and then we end up complaining why they can't teach this way. And then products, say that I kind of analogize it with like the Atari games. I grew up loving Atari, but you know what? Now the gaming in the world has changed so much. It's almost 4D. You can smell things, things vibrate, things, blah, blah. Yeah, I still like my Atari, but you know what? We can put the Atari down and we can adapt to some of the new things that are out there that the learners need and embrace. The world has changed and our products haven't changed. And some of those unfortunate things that are happening now that everybody will have a device, knock on wood, hopefully, and with a decent amount of access, to your point, Elizabeth, we can change away from textbooks. We can be much more prescriptive. Mm-hmm. There's always that saying, the last 2 years is where 90% of the data was formed. There's going to be new entrants of new technologies, 5G, all these IoT, edge computing. These are all around the corner. And we will continuously fall further and further behind in making sure that AR technologies are resilient, agile, but also secure. If you've just seen the recent news of all the ransomware that's happening, there's a lot of bad actors out there that are taking advantage of a lot of the rush, you know, that we have had to really create a resilient enterprise-grade IT system in 5 months. And right now, there's a lot of tripping and falling over. And unfortunately, a lot of bad actors are taking full advantage of that right now. And that's a sad state. And we need to fix that and make sure that we're building it the right way in products. I'm not saying everyone needs to buy with the same product, but work together, collaborate amongst regions, work with your peers in your universities or your systems, and make decisions decisively, but also keep equity and access and all those things at the top of mind as well.
Absolutely. And I think you spoke to so many really salient points and areas of concern and things that universities, colleges and universities, and also those of us that are parents know in K-12 really need to be addressed and really thought through in logistics and planning and just mm-hmm. incorporating technology and being more responsive to our students, accessibility. There's so much that needs to be unpacked there. Mm-hmm. When you alluded to earlier this idea of consulting with a college and them telling you just the lengthy process and just, you know, all the hoops that need to be jumped through, when you go mm-hmm. into a K-12 system or if you go into a college or university, you're consulting with them and guiding them, what does that process look like? If the college is wanting to reach out to you and they're trying to kind of navigate how you're going to be able to enhance their process, what would you say that would look like as opposed to what they're currently doing? Because the business as usual, we know it's not working. So how are you able to enhance that process?
Well, often it's sort of the they have right now. Number one, I first will say I feel for all the individuals who are in education. It is a tough time for everybody, down to the bus driver, to the president, provost, the board members. I usually get pulled in when there's always a problem. And recently it's been around a lot of ransomware that's been happening. Now, I myself am not an expertise in cybersecurity ransomware, but again, even my whole Covexa is that it's not about me, but it's like who I know that I can definitely draw in and get some really, really scary smart people who can go in there I don't know how much they could save and help them when the situation is already passed, but let's make sure that it doesn't happen again because it is often that it does happen more than once. I would say there's those type of situations. Are you ready and have you thought through all the areas that you need to just maintain an online state? And I just mentioned a few so that I introduce other concepts of like just the one that I just mentioned before was even around the authentic proctoring or AI proctoring. People didn't realize that how am I going to get my assessments? How am I going to do that? Number two, how are they measuring student engagement in a digital world? This is probably the biggest one that many of them still don't understand how they will. Not just for assessments, but how are they feeling and what's the social, emotional challenges that the students are facing. It's really difficult to measure all that in this particular state. And so that's where then will provide some recommendations of certain types of companies and technologies that actually could do certain things in order to understand and measure those with certain level of efficacy and accuracy to get a pulse. It won't be perfected, but get a pulse what's really happening out there outside of just logging in someone's time and use on a device, which unfortunately a lot of folks are just relying on very low common denominator ways of measuring engagement. Number two, sharing best practices, introducing them to other folks. There's a university president in one particular university in California, a good friend of mine, and they're trying to open back a hybrid, going back to school physically on the campus. How do they handle that? While there's no universal answer, but they're already talking to one another, I introduce them, hey, what about this idea that I just heard from this other university president or this particular, you know, provost who are handling it in certain situations? For example, I asked individuals, you know, when we're going back to work, physically work, there's a lot of tracking and tracing applications. It's like a big thing. It's all on television. Why are we not doing that for education? And it's a massive concentration of individuals coming in there. Wouldn't you want to know if a third grader child had COVID before or their cousin had it? Self-reporting, I know it's not perfected, but even some of those small mechanisms to keep, you know, we'll call it some level of assurance, not perfected, some level of safety. And it's not so much the students because of all the staff that come out, but even the faculty for their safety. It's important for us and responsible to look at it holistically across the board. And so often it's not, there's no one answer because there hasn't been a perfected solution. And I would knock on, I'll just dare to say that no one got it perfect right now. Nobody has it perfect.
Absolutely. That's really wise advice. And I think what you hit the nail on the head in terms of something that higher education sometimes hasn't been as responsive to, which is the idea of collaboration. The idea of, hey, if you don't know, bring in somebody that does know. You know, we are a community here. And I think if nothing else, going through these times of COVID has really kind of brought us to a point where we really are waking up to the idea that we don't function very well if we just kind of stay in our own little narrow field of view and don't look outside to get expert advice from those that have more experience. So I'm still so really happy and thrilled that you were able to share a lot of these insights with us today, your advice in some of your high-level expertise in these areas in terms of technology and innovation and disruption are extremely valuable. So we know that your time is very, very valuable yourself, and we appreciate you taking this time out to join us and discuss some of these really important issues with us today. So we want to be cognitive and aware of your time and just ask you a couple last questions that maybe you can give us some additional insight on. The first question is what you see as the future of education, whether higher education or the K-12 system, and any last words that you want to share with us about COVEX and what you guys are doing and what people do.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it's always my pleasure. And I didn't want this to be like a grim reaper type of thing. I would just say I am confident we're going to come out of this much better than what we were before. I'm very confident because just knowing the resiliency of the leaders that we have there, we've all are caught off guard of this. And as long as we work together and be smart about things, I think we can come out even better. And that is my hope and part of my charter that I'd love to see. To your point, when it comes to, I forgot the question, was it when it comes to COVID, I'm sorry, COVEXA.
COVEXA, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be definitely going down a path of now building. I'm a builder, and while I love the connections and helping, I would say my desire and passion is to accelerate that. And so I would say, I'm definitely going to be creating new types of products and services and offerings. I would just say stay tuned. I'm looking for volunteers. And when I say the volunteers, talking about individuals in the education system who, you know, understand that there are new technologies and just may not be well-versed to understand what's out there. We have some incredible clients that are willing to do some pilots just to showcase how you can do things, save money, and really protect and improve a learning environment. I have so many clients, I can't spew them out there, but definitely volunteers to just take a look at trying new things to help. I guarantee you they will. Where do I see education as future? I'm gonna say something another time. I believe education is going to become a service. I believe at some point, it's no longer going to be about the borders. I think at some point, and I say some point, hopefully in my lifetime, I'd like to see a lot of the connectivities between true, we'll call it, and I hate to get in a buzzword, but these credentials that are connected to the actual core part of our education system and curriculum. We have yet to break through that. I see other countries doing it right now. I see them doing it right now. And we as a country here in the U.S., and I know that this is probably not just focused in the U.S., we've got to wake up to it. The whole world stopped at the same time. And who's going to come out? The digital economy needs knowledge with people. And, you know, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, 5G, these are all right there. And those are the type of jobs and those are the type of innovation and economy that will be pervasive. But we're in that inflection point. So I hope and education plays such a vital role. I hope we do become some level of a service.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit edupexperience.com. And if you want to be in on the live recordings, please sign up for our email list. Go to edupexperience.com and sign up to be a subscriber. We'll let you know how you can listen in live and get the scoop before anyone else does. So please, as always, feel free to share this podcast. Rate, review, and subscribe. We would really, really appreciate that. You've been listening to The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, with your hosts, Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Liva, and Elvin Freitas.